raw data for breakfast.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Good morning and happy Friday from American Public Media in Los Angeles. It's the Morning Open. I'm Steve Chiatakis. A couple of economic indicators came out this morning. What do they mean? That's ahead. Now, where's Wall Street? Dow is up about 0.2%, 15 points at this moment. We have the NASDAQ up about 0.1%, and S&P 500 down, pretty much flat across the board this morning for Wall Street. Asian shares closed higher today, 1-2%, but that's before Panasonic reported a $4 billion fiscal year loss. European markets are lower right now. A report this morning said the Eurozone economy shrank by 2.5% last quarter. All right, Bill Stone, Chief Investment Strategist at PNC Wealth Management, joining us live right now from Philadelphia. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us. More barometers, of course. The nation's industrial production fell in April, the smallest amount in half a year. Another report out of New York indicates pretty much the same. I mean, I don't like celebrating decreased production, but is this good news?
It is good news. It's, again, providing further evidence that at least the economy seems to be stabilizing. You know, that thing that people keep saying is getting worse at a slower rate, but it's much better than the free fall.
U.S. consumer prices, Bill, didn't budge in April, but for the 12-month period, it's the biggest recorded drop in like more than 50 years. Retail numbers were pretty lousy this week, yet prices are lower. If I'm a business trying to sell something, what do I do?
Well, I think it does. Outside of tobacco, almost all of the prices were down, you know, and it is impacting particularly some of the retailers as far as their earnings go because they can't sell things for as much. But part of that should help or actually turn around as the economy hopefully starts to rebuild itself. At least that's certainly what the policymakers are trying to accomplish.
It's all sort of teetering on deflation, inflation, all of that, trying to keep a healthy balance.
Exactly.
All right. Bill Stone, Chief Investment Strategist at PNC Wealth Management. Thanks for being with us. Have a great weekend.
Thanks. You too.
All right. The U.S. Senate in Washington takes up a credit card reform package again today. A lot of changes on the table there. The latest from Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith.
At the grocery store near my office, you have to spend at least $5 to pay with a credit or debit card. That's because merchants pay the bank a fee every time you use plastic. It's usually about 2% of your purchase. A lot of stores just build that cost into prices, so you pay it even if you use cash. Craig Sherman is with the National Retail Federation.
Retailers have always wanted to be able to discount for customers who pay cash, but Visa and MasterCard rules make it virtually impossible to do that.
An amendment to the credit card reform bill, now making its way through Congress, would let retailers give discounts for cash. Trish Wexler is with the Electronic Payments Coalition. It represents banks and credit card companies.
This amendment would remove all sort of enforcement on how merchants advertise their cash discount.
Wexler says retailers could advertise the cash price and then hit shoppers using credit cards with a higher price at the register. Shoppers pay about $48 billion a year in interchange fees. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
You're listening to The Morning Report on Friday, May 15th, 2009, at Marketplace.org. It's being called a lifeline to those companies that sell life insurance. Today, the Treasury Department is adding several companies that sell insurance to the Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP. That's the $700 billion bailout package passed last year to rescue banks and AIG. From New York, here's Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson.
Life insurers have been asking for a government bailout for months. They're not getting nearly as much as the banks, reportedly $22 billion split among six companies, among them Hartford Financial and Prudential. Insurers, like everyone else with so much cash on hand, invested in stocks and bonds that plummeted in value, and some companies insured against market losses. Christopher Whalen of Institutional Risk Analytics says share prices of those life insurers have been falling, leading some to worry about the consequences of firms failing.
It has enormous implications and a ripple through the economy, consumers, businesses, everybody.
For instance, life insurers own 18% of the nation's corporate bonds, which are a vital source of cash to businesses, large and small. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
We mentioned just a minute ago, Europe is sliding deeper into recession. Numbers out today for the first quarter show a bigger than expected decline in the Eurozone and in the continent's largest economy. From the European desk in London, here's Stephen Beard.
Germany's GDP fell by 3.8% in the first 3 months of the year, the country's largest quarterly contraction since the Second World War. Tumbling exports are largely to blame. Like Japan, Germany has been hit very hard by the collapse in world trade, and the rest of Europe is feeling the effect. The Eurozone economy declined by a whopping 2.5% in the first quarter. Graham Mather is with the European Policy Forum.
Seems to be bad luck that Europe has become such a world-trading, export-focused economy led by Germany that when there's a worldwide problem, Europe really suffers.
The International Monetary Fund reckons that Europe will fare much worse than the United States this year. Graham Mather says many European politicians are miffed by this, since they blame the US for causing the crisis. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
It's been a couple decades of delays and setbacks, arguments and lawsuits. But today, General Electric begins dredging the upper part of New York's Hudson River. In 2002, the Environmental Protection Agency ordered GE to clear the river of toxic chemicals called polychlorinated biphenyls. Those are dangerous PCBs to you and me. Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
GE admitted polluting the Hudson for 30 years, but said it was perfectly legal at the time. Now the company is about to spend $780 million cleaning the river up. Manager Joe Green is environmental director for Hudson River Sloop Clearwater.
I really want to commend General Electric. The treatment facility they have built is state-of-the-art. It has very high safety standards.
GE will separate the PCBs from river sediment in enclosed space so no chemicals escape into the air. Green says a change at the top has helped this project get underway.
From Jack Welch, who absolutely felt that GE was not responsible and, in fact, it was not a problem, to Jeffrey Immelt with his eco-imagination.
Green says the full dredging project will take 6 to 10 years, but she says it'll be a few generations before fish from that part of the river are safe to eat. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
By the way, GE has not officially committed to performing the second phase of that cleanup. Today in Hong Kong, delegates from 64 countries signed a new pact regulating how old ships are recycled for scrap metal. Mostly those ships are disassembled on the beaches of India and Bangladesh. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
The agreement requires ship owners to give recyclers detailed logs of any hazardous materials their ships transported. It also calls on recyclers to provide their workers with adequate protective gear. But activists say that's not enough.
It's not going to stop one single toxic ship from being broken on the beaches of developing countries.
Jim Puckett heads the environmental advocacy group Basel Action Network. He says there's a reason the shipping industry supports the pact's new guidelines.
They don't even prescribe how a ship should be broken. It's left to the states of India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh to decide to apply those guidelines or not. And currently they're not, and they have no incentive to do so.
Especially since business is booming, shipping companies are scrapping a record number of older ships in response to the collapse in global trade. And because it's cheaper, most of those ships will end up on the beaches of South Asia. I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
All this week, Marketplace has been looking at the next American dream. Today, what immigration means to the future of this nation. For decades, more people came from Latin America to the United States than from any other region in the world. But stricter border enforcement and fewer jobs are slowing those numbers. Princeton University sociology professor Douglas Massey says there are consequences to these changes. Professor, good morning. Welcome. What has immigration from Latin America meant to the U.S. economy over the years?
Well, it's been the major source of low-wage labor in the United States. It has played a leading role in sustaining the economic boom of the 1990s. As the boom of the 1990s developed, we hit record levels of low unemployment rates that economists said before couldn't be achieved without causing inflation. And yet by the late 1990s, we had rates of 4% or so. And we would have reached bottlenecks with labor shortages had it not been for immigration and immigrants coming into the country.
But you don't think that if there is a shortage of jobs that people will say, you know, that more Americans and not immigrants will say, okay, well, I'm getting a little desperate here. I don't mind changing the bedpans or going out and picking tomatoes or something like that.
Well, in the short term, that may be true. But in the longer term, I think we'll return to a situation where those jobs will either be filled by immigrants or they will disappear or move overseas. Every developed country has now become a country of immigration, and it's built into the economic structure of post-industrial societies, and it's built into the demography of post-industrial societies.
Let's talk a little bit about the fallout that we're dealing with right now and the fact that the economy is in its worst shape than it has been in 70 years in many cases. You know, how does immigration affect that? Where do we see immigration going and how does it play into sort of reviving the economy of today and from now on?
Well, in the short term, immigration is part and parcel of the dynamics of the economy. And so when the economy goes sour, immigration slows down. And that's exactly what we're observing. And if the economic slump continues, you'll see that trend continue. When the economy revives and jobs are created, you'll see a response in our immigration flows. The key for us is to figure out ways to manage this and handle these flows legally in ways that protect American workers and protect the rights of the immigrants themselves.
Professor Douglas Massey, a professor of sociology at Princeton, specializes in immigration. We thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Check out our Next American Dream section inside marketplace.org. We've got a reporter's notebook there, and you can share your thoughts. There's an audio slideshow, too, all that. In that special section, The Next American Dream, marketplace.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Have a great weekend.
American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.